Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another podcast. I'm Christina Vogt, Assistant Editor for Consultant360.com. I'm speaking today with Dr. Kim Carmichael, who is a professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology, Metabolism, and Lipid Research at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He is also the author of Consultant's quarterly diabetes Q&A column. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Carmichael.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and to our audience members. I do need to let you know that the views that I give are my own and not necessarily those of Washington University.
Today, our discussion will be centered around one of his recent diabetes Q&As, What Do You Need to Know About Diabetic Gastroparesis? So, Dr. Carmichael, how common is diabetic gastroparesis, and what factors may increase a patient's risk of developing this condition?
Well, thank you. First of all, I need to define gastroparesis, which is a combination of symptoms plus a documented delay in gastric emptying in the absence of any evidence of mechanical obstruction. In terms of the incidence of gastroparesis, the tertiary care center prevalence of gastroparesis is estimated to be about 40% among people with type 1 diabetes and 10 to 20% of people with type 2, and then less common among people who do not have diabetes. In the general community, however, the 10-year incidence is estimated to be about 5.2% in type 1 and 1% in type 2, so it's much more common in tertiary medical centers.
What symptoms typically occur in diabetic gastroparesis?
Well, typically associated with nausea, vomiting, postprandial fullness, bloating, and early satiety. More common with idiopathic gastroparesis, but the abdominal pain is more common and exacerbated by eating and interfering with sleep. It may exacerbate the symptoms of gastroesophageal reflux disease and often is refractory to acid-reducing medications.
What consequences can occur if diabetic gastroparesis goes undiagnosed or untreated?
Well, in persons with diabetes, gastroparesis may also be associated with hypoglycemia because the timing of the insulin and the timing of when the meal is absorbed may differ. You can have anorexia with a loss of appetite, weight loss, malnutrition. And there's a recent analysis estimating that approximately 35% of the peak postprandial glucose excursion is modulated by the rate of gastric emptying.
How is diabetic gastroparesis diagnosed, and what is the differential diagnosis for this condition?
First of all, the diagnosis, in order to distinguish from other forms of gastrointestinal disease, particularly conditions associated with accelerated gastric emptying, the diagnosis really has to be confirmed by way of documenting delayed gastric emptying. This is most commonly done by way of scintigraphic evidence of retention of solids at 4 hours. Some people have used wireless capsule mobility testing and radioactive carbon breath testing, but these are less reliable. Some people have actually used functional ultrasonography to be considered for diagnosis. However, in all cases, you need to stop medication that affects gastric emptying at least 48 hours in advance, and glucose control should be optimized. And what we need to do is, again, rule out other causes of gastroparesis. For example, you can have rumination syndrome and eating disorders that have to be considered. And usually in those situations, the regurgitation occurs within about 15 minutes of starting a meal. But with gastroparesis, it tends to be quite a bit later. There's a syndrome of cyclic vomiting syndrome, which may have similar symptoms associated with rapid gastric emptying during the symptom-free period. There's chronic use of cannabinoid agents, and marijuana can be associated with symptoms similar to gastroparesis. Some people with diabetes may have chronic pancreatic enzyme insufficiency, which can cause gastrointestinal bloating, but it's not associated with delayed gastric emptying. And then there are rarer causes of non-diabetic gastroparesis, including neurological diseases such as Parkinsonism, amyloidosis, paraneoplastic disease, gastric infiltrative disease or sarcoidosis, and mesenteric ischemia. So these things need to be ruled out before you proceed with some type of treatment modality.
How is diabetic gastroparesis typically managed and treated?
In treating, you need to consider that markedly uncontrolled diabetes, for example, glucose levels greater than 200, and motility-affecting medications such as anticholinergic agents, narcotics, pramlintide, GLP-1 agonists can often exacerbate the symptoms in the setting of gastroparesis. A particular note, DPP-4 inhibitors do not affect gastric emptying, so that's not an issue. But again, in part of the management, you need to look at other potential conditions and medications and situations that could be contributing to the symptoms. Some people may present with gastroparesis after a viral illness, which may be self-limited. Their symptoms are not directly related to the gastric emptying rate and more common in the presence of anxiety and depression. The other thing is that in looking at treatment of gastroparesis, you have to consider possible thyroid, autoimmune, or neurological disorders and a history of prior gastrointestinal surgery. So these should all be considered when developing a treatment protocol. So the first thing you need to do is stop medications that slow gastric motility and optimize the glycemic control, as we mentioned before. Persons should avoid alcohol, tobacco, and carbonated beverages, which may increase the symptoms. Of particular importance is in more advanced cases, maybe people who sometimes even require hospitalization, one should restore fluids and electrolytes because somebody can get markedly dehydrated. You can get poor nutrition, so you need to provide nutritional support, preferably enteral, and get formal nutrition counseling in more severe and advanced cases. This may involve more frequent small volume meals, liquid or homogenized meals. The nutrition should be low in fat, in soluble fiber, and then again, in more severe instances, people may need post-pyloric feeding, such as a G-tube or a J-tube. In some patients, prokinetic therapy may be beneficial. Initially, one may use the lowest effective dose of liquid metoclopramide. The liquid, obviously, is better absorbed and better tolerated, and having a lower dose minimizes the risk of side effects of this type of medication, such as tardive dyskinesia or movement disorders. Some people may benefit from erythromycin, but they're more prone to develop tachyphylaxis with prolonged usage, so it may just be a short-term fix. Some patients have been given tricyclic antidepressants, which may alleviate the symptoms of the nausea and vomiting, but they do not affect the gastric emptying rate. Some people have even tried empirical off-label medication for symptomatic relief, such as phenothiazines, antihistamines, 5-HT receptor agonists, thermal scopolamine, but there's really no evidence that these affect the overall effectiveness and safety. There's some evidence that acupuncture may improve emptying and symptom relief in some patients, but again, no real well-controlled studies to show that. In terms of surgical management, some people have used gastric electrical stimulation, and it's considered to be a possible humanitarian device exception from the FDA, so this would, in some cases, be FDA-approved therapy. Some people have tried gastrotomy or venting, jejunostomy for feeding, and completion gastrectomy has been used in some people who have failed other medical or surgical treatment. Some patients have been reported with benefit from endoscopic pyelorhabdomy, but again, this is only in occasional places where they've had extensive experience with this. Some people have promoted the idea of giving intrapyloric injection of botulinum toxin or surgical pyloroplasty or jejunostomy, but those have been shown to be ineffective and they are not recommended for persons with gastroparesis. So the range of treatment from gastroparesis goes from symptom management, diet, nutrition, adjusting medications that may exacerbate or improve symptoms, and in more severe cases, more advanced nutrition therapy, fluids, and surgical management.
Thanks again for joining me today, Dr. Carmichael.
Thank you very much.